everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, historian John Bew reveals how a love of books guided one of Britain's greatest prime ministers.
The only time Attlee pulls strings and goes to his public school network is to get in the army and serve on the front line.
Broadcaster Jonathan Dimbleby tells Robert Kirkwood about the Battle of El Alamein and reveals a surprising talent for mimicry.
This is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end. But it is, perhaps, the end of the beginning.
And biographer Marion Vivers compares the lives of Dorothy Wordsworth and Jane Austen.
Jane valued sense and Dorothy valued sensibility, so they were the qualities that they aspired to.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. John Bew is a professor of history and foreign policy at King's London. Still only in his 30s, he's already published 5 highly regarded books on modern history. The most recent is Citizen Clem, the biography of Clement Attlee, the Labour leader who stood shoulder to shoulder with Winston Churchill during World War II, then dealt him a crushing defeat in the 1945 general election. In the 6 years that followed, Prime Minister Attlee oversaw the introduction of the welfare state, including the NHS. But he was an unlikely revolutionary, and the constant butt of jokes about his lack of personality. Lloyd George dismissed him as a pygmy, and Churchill called him a very modest man indeed, who has a great deal to be modest about. Professor John Bew told me more about this remarkably unremarkable man. At the beginning of the book, you use a very telling quote from an earlier biography, which calls Clement Attlee a revolutionary buttoned up in a cricket blazer. And it's very much the story of an unassuming man's triumph in a time of great egos, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that appealed to me about Clement Attlee. From memory now, and you're testing me, but I think that quote is from R.J. Cruikshank, who's a historian of the Victorian Liberal Party, but one who was writing in the mid-20th century and was able to look around at what he saw in the 20th century and also cast his mind back to the 19th. And that was precisely the thing he saw in Attlee. If you think about the great prime ministers we tend to remember, like Churchill, most obviously, but also Gladstone in the 19th century, you know, these big personalities, Attlee's much more unassuming, much quieter, much more reticent, doesn't do all the things that kind of bring you political legend status. He's not a great speaker. He's not a great writer, doesn't write history himself, so therefore, you know, he can't quite, you know, curate our knowledge of the past. All these things would suggest, you know, Attlee sort of would easily sort of pass beside the wayside. And what Cruikshank was saying was actually he kind of snuck up on everyone. And he's a remarkable political figure in terms of what he achieved in terms of changing Britain, both in terms of domestic legislation, both in terms of its international standing. And actually he did so without sort of, you know, smashing lots of drums and pots and pans. And did so in a very quiet, effective manner.
And certainly you point out that he has heroic tendencies. He served with quite a lot of honour and bravery in the First World War at Gallipoli and Kut, and was really a child of the Empire raised on Rudyard Kipling, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things I kind of wanted to bring across. I mean, Attlee is not your conventional socialist. In fact, I say towards the end of the book, in the conclusion, that Britain, depending on one's perspective, has been blessed or cursed with an abundance of public school socialists. Attlee is a public school socialist, but he's different than a lot of them for the following reasons. First of all, he doesn't actually reject empire at any stage. Now, he more than any politician on the left, brings the British Empire to an end, but that's not a repudiation of its original purpose. That really, for Attlee, is making good on the promise that Queen Victoria made, making good on the promise that was always held out, but in fact never delivered in the empire, which was self-government and the rule of law. And actually, Attlee regards, you know, Indian independence as a part of that. So that kind of imperial sentimentality, the belief that we, you know, eventually we did right by India, much as we did ugly things in the past, is absolutely crucial to understanding Attlee. You also referred to his war record, which is kind of a mixed bag. Attlee's heroism, and I do think it is heroism, and I make the case for a kind of a heroic aspect to the Attlee story. But it's not a conventional form of heroism. The big example of it is his service in the First World War, which he's already above the age of conscription, and he goes above and beyond to get himself a commission in Kitchener's army in 1914. So he's the only time Attlee pulls strings and goes to his public school network is to get in the army and serve on the front line. And it's more remarkable given that his brother is a conscientious objector during the First World War. So he's really marking himself out for his brother, and he's saying, look, I'm committing to fighting. I think pacifism is wrong, much as I love you. You know, I think he regards his brother as a damned fool in this issue. And when he does join the army, he's carried off the battlefield three times. Now, it's kind of said it's typical of Attlee that none of them, all these injuries he receives, none of them are by enemy fire. In the first instance, he's carried off the beach at Gallipoli before the main assault of his South Lancashire regiment, through essentially what looks to be dysentery. So he gets sick and he misses the main assault, and actually he regards himself as rather lucky that he missed an assault in which many of his comrades died. Secondly, in Kut and Almara, which is where actually the modern British soldiers find themselves again in Iraq, in Mesopotamia, as Attlee would have referred to it after 2003 again, Attlee leads his regiment over the line and he's hit by shrapnel and artillery fire from his own side, so he's hit by friendly fire. That's his most serious injury in the war, and he has cuts and lacerations to his back and his thigh and his buttocks. And then the final time he's carried off is when he insists once again, he's sick of training people to fight in the front line if he can't fight himself, pushes himself forward and fights in Flanders and France towards the end of the war. And at that crucial moment, Attlee's hit by a falling piece of timber. So on three occasions, despite this sort of personal bravery, it's not, you know, being shot by enemy fire that Attlee suffered. But there is absolutely, there's a political bravery in that. There's a sense of commitment to one's nation. And that really, you know, is crucial to Attlee throughout his career.
And that sense of patriotism really comes through. It's not the sort of jingoistic patriotism that, I suppose, led Germany and Italy to adopt fascism, but it's a sense in the good that the nation of Great Britain can do.
Absolutely. Attlee says towards the end of his life, you know, he feels honoured to have served in the trenches and served politically the nation he regards as the greatest on earth. Now, he does not believe that nation is without flaws, and he thinks it's gone on the wrong path, both in terms of domestic politics and in terms of its foreign policy and its attitude to empire. So he can be hugely critical of the British nation, and in fact he does a huge amount to fix it, but he doesn't repudiate or reject the nation like these other public school socialists that you have in later generations. You know, Attlee actually does believe that Britain is this force for good if these things can be fixed within it. And just to say, you know, that story of Britain avoiding, you mentioned Italy, for example, or the jingoism you had in Germany or other European states, or that people like Oswald Mosley fell into, Attlee absolutely steers clear of it. And we tend to think, because Britain didn't go down that path, that it was somehow inevitable that we avoided these things. Just to give you, you know, two examples of how things might have been different. First of all, when Attlee's in a boy's home reading about early socialist ideas and statistics and how the state needs to gird itself for a new 20th century. This is in 1906. He picks up the writings of this Anglo-Italian writer called Chiozzamani. Now, Chiozzamani later on and becomes a massive supporter of fascism, an apologist for both Mussolini and Hitler, and Attlee rebukes him 30 years later in the late 1930s before the war. So Chiozzamani, who's an early socialist, goes that way. Another example is Francis Beckett, who's Attlee's constituency secretary in Limehouse after the war. He's another one who turns to fascism as well. So two friends of Attlee who influenced him, who started with him on the left, actually end up in this strange place. And many other people do that in the 1930s as well. So it's no inevitable achievement that Britain steers clear of these other tendencies. But one reason it does is Attlee's sort of moderate sense of patriotism as something that can be fixed and improved, rather than racial superiority and pride.
And he's reading all the way through his life. I love the way that you take what he has read from his diaries, from letters that he's written, and you show that reading things like Ruskin and William Morris's News from Nowhere and Edward Bellamy's book Looking Backwards, both of which are socialist utopian books, informs the way that he envisages the welfare state that he will eventually help to create.
Absolutely. I mean, reading is absolutely crucial to Attlee, and it seems like an obvious thing to say, but I think the reason why I wanted to flag up that side about it is for two reasons, actually. First reason is that Attlee is not a conventional intellectual, so he doesn't write a lot down. And therefore, there's a tendency to sort of dismiss him and say, oh, he's sort of damned with faint praise. Like, he was a good chairman, reliable colleague, kind of a steady Eddie type of figure, but never really thought about things. And I think that's actually completely wrong. If you look to the letters to his brother, he's constantly thinking and reading and reflecting on the world around him. So that's the first reason. It's a kind of a response to dismissive intellectuals, particularly on the left, who kind of sneered at Attlee. The second reason is, you know, as a biographer, you want to say something new about your character, the person you're addressing, and Attlee presents a bit of a problem for biographers. It's a bit of poetry, which adds a sense of his life, and previous biographers have focused on the poetry. But, you know, he doesn't have these great speeches. His own autobiography is so short and boring as to be, you know, largely laughed at. It's called As It Happened, kind of a matter of fact. You know, one day I woke up, had my breakfast, next minute we had a Labour government. It's very hard to sort of crack the Attlee code and dig a bit deeper. So I wanted to read the books that Attlee read. And I could have just said, oh, look, he was influenced by William Morris and Ruskin and all these people. But actually, I wanted to look at the way in which he was influenced by them and what ideas he took from them, but also what ideas he rejected. And just to focus on one, William Morris is a massively important figure for the British socialist movement, a man who believed essentially that Britain had taken a wrong turn with rapid industrialization, and Morris's utopias were kind of rural, Arcadian, almost sort of medieval England. He wanted to go back to the time of the Peasants' Revolt, in which you'd have no lords and aristocrats, but you would have a rural agrarian society in which everyone shared, a kind of a rural agrarian Marxist society in which everyone shared the means of production. And I just couldn't help thinking that wasn't quite Attlee. It seems sort of small-c conservative, a little bit backward, if anything. And you know, the more I looked, the more I found actually he was influenced by an alternative American socialist writer called Edward Bellamy. What's interesting about that is that William Morris's utopia of the future, which was one in which there's no motor cars in London, there's no pollution, people salmon fish in the Thames, all the shops at Piccadilly are free to take anything you want, there's no commerce, there's no police, the state has melted away. Actually, that was written in reaction to this American socialist writer, Edward Bellamy. And Edward Bellamy had a kind of a utopian vision of the future that looked more like Blade Runner, in which everything was modern. It was set in Boston in the 22nd century, in which basically workers could do what they wanted at the weekend, but they had to work hard during the week. There was hierarchy at the workplace. You had to fight wars occasionally for your state. So it's a much more kind of modern view of the state. And funny enough, when Edward Bellamy's son visits Attlee in 1948, Attlee says, my government is a child of the Bellamy idea. So he starts with William Morris, like all British socialists, and then he ends up in this different place. And I think Attlee's embrace of modernity and recognition that the world can't just, you know, return to this previous beautiful state before the Industrial Revolution is absolutely crucial to understanding the whole story of the Labour Party.
It's very much a sense of rights with duties, isn't it?
That's a huge aspect of Attlee. I mean, that's really that is the DNA to Attlee's whole career, which is the society and the Commonwealth expects a dialogue between rights and responsibilities. You can't just take from the state in this broader sense as well. If you're fighting for the state, you're fighting for your nation, you're showing loyalty to community, then you deserve things back. And really, Attlee, it's shaped so much by those two world wars. In the First World War, he's one of those who volunteer, or others who are basically conscripted to go and fight for Britain in this First World War, who feel cheated and abused and not looked after the war, whether it be housing, social welfare, safety and security and employment. Basically, that generation feels betrayed. And it's Attlee's political mission after 1918 to make sure that never happens again. So when it comes to the Second World War, having spent 20 years railing against the betrayal of those who fought in the First, there's no way Attlee's government's going to allow that to happen again after 1945. And those two sort of great rewards for the duties and the responsibilities of those who fight for their nation and put everything aside to keep the nation survive, that sense in which they have to be looked after in a post-war era, it really sort of is the driving force behind Attlee's political thought.
And actually the Second World War provides the opportunity to create the welfare state by the state ownership, the enforced state ownership during the Second World War of industry.
That's absolutely crucial. So H.G. Wells, a contemporary of Attlee and the great socialist thinker, someone, of course, who dealt with lots of different types of utopias in the future, embraced modernity, says in May 1940, when the coalition government is formed and barricades go up across Westminster and the Nazi invasion is expected, and which basically the trade unions are brought into the centre of government, state takes over industry, everyone is in full employment. H.G. Wells says the revolution's already happened. Basically, to fight the Second World War, Britain has to socialise its state, has to adopt socialist methods to fight or compete with those different methods, Nazi methods in the first instance, latterly communist methods as well. This is seen as the only way you can compete in the game of national survival. So really, in that sense, that structural transformation during the Second World War really enables Attlee's government, with state ownership of industry, plus full employment, plus the mobilisation of the whole industry sort of geared towards national survival and exports after the war, this thing really becomes the sort of foundation stone for Attlee's government. So it can tinker with the legislation and all these crucial things because it has full employment, because it has mass manufacturing industry. And those are things bequeathed by the war.
And in very many ways, whilst Churchill is running foreign affairs during the Second World War, it's Attlee who's running the home front.
That's a crucial relationship between the two. And again, it's hard to say things that are new about your subject, and Attlee's been the subject of 7 previous biographies. Not as many of Churchill, of course. I think it was 600 biographies at the last time of counting on Churchill. So there's a slight imbalance there. But, you know, how do you say something different? And actually, to my surprise, I think the relationship between Attlee and Churchill is even more important than any of his previous biographers had recognised. And it's not just in the home front, let me say. Attlee is backs Churchill on a number of crucial decisions. And people forget in this glorious story of Churchill that actually for the first 2 years of the war, really up until the end of 1942, and the North African campaign, Churchill is not having it his own way. Things are going very badly. A lot of his friends in government are trying to force him out. And he really counts on this reliance on Attlee and the fact that Attlee can keep the Labour members in government the whole time. And so when things are going badly for Churchill, Attlee backs him. It's later in the war when Churchill seems omnipotent and untouchable that Attlee begins to push back against him. And he pushes back against him on the home front. Round about the summer of 1943, Conservatives start whispering in Churchill's ear that basically he's given up control of the home front to Labour. And concerns start to emerge in the coalition on the Conservative side that essentially Labour has had its own way. And it's putting things in place that will not be movable after the war. So basically handing over this home front becomes a crucial thing. And Attlee has control of much of that home front. And he does it, he changes things in a very effective, quiet way. I should also give huge credit here to Ernest Bevin, who is the other, a second key member of the coalition, and also Herbert Morrison, with whom Attlee clashed a lot, but also is a crucial figure in terms of mobilising this post-war state. But these three really do steal the march on the Conservatives, and then there's a panic in the Conservative side towards the end of the war that actually they've got away with making a lot of changes very subtly. But finally, Attlee's also under immense pressure from his own far left in the party as well, who are constantly hounding him for not doing enough, for not bringing down the government, for not rushing through changes when there's an opportunity. But Attlee plays a very cautious, strategically astute game, I think, throughout the war, and is able to set the basis for the 1945 election.
And actually, he flags that up in his 1930 autobiography, The Social Worker, where he very much advocates patience and tolerance. It's a long game, politics, for Clement Attlee, isn't it?
Absolutely. I would say the social worker, which is based on his experiences as a social worker. I mean, this is a man who's, you know, two decades in basically not quite the trenches, but, you know, two decades in local politics and boys' homes and municipal politics, fighting on street corners, etc. He's seen it all before he even goes into Parliament in 1922. And this book's actually written before that, and I regard it as a kind of hidden script of the 20th century Labour Party. And it says some fascinating things about, you know, people who will push things too fast, people who think their own ideas are so pure that they won't entertain the ideas of others, people who impugn or disrespect conservatives, even though Attlee firmly disagrees with them. He doesn't think the other side is evil. And he thinks it's really problematic when you call the other side evil and you don't have respect for other people's opinions. So there's a liberalism in the truest sense, small L liberalism, and a sense of tolerance being Britain's great political gift. I think Attlee has that right from the sense, and it informs much of his politics thereafter. It's why he's able to appeal, unlike any Labour leader, with the exceptions, of course, of Wilson and Blair, who are perhaps on a par with him. He's able to appeal to people who are not natural Labour Party supporters, who don't identify with the trade union, who don't regard politics as a kind of a zero-sum game. And Attlee's one of the, you know, these three great Labour figures who were able to do that over the course of the 20th century. It's because he has this sense of tolerance. You know, he doesn't believe his own conscience, his own sense of vision, you know, is necessary. Well, he believes it's the right one, but he also recognises that people don't necessarily share it. I think that's something perhaps we've slightly lost in our current political atmosphere.
I fear you've preempted my next question. I was going to say, when in a world that seems to have quite a few echoes of the 1930s in it at the moment, where is the new Clement Attlee? Do you see anybody in Parliament who has his qualities of patience, tolerance?
I hasten to say no. I think it's too easy to kind of condemn our political classes for being, you know, not on the ball. What's interesting, if you twist the question around in a way that allows me to be polite, but damn with faint praise, Attlee kind of experienced this weird return to fashion about 2013. So first of all, Ed Miliband, who's leader of the Labour Party, said, well, there's two things that inspire me about Attlee. First of all, everyone underrated him, like they underrate me, and he came through in the end. Secondly, he managed to do great things at a time of austerity. So he changed things politically, even though there wasn't much money around. But of course, Ed Miliband went by the wayside. Next, you had David Cameron in that election saying the current Labour Party had no right to claim the Attleeism as their heir, and the, you know, if Attlee was around today, he'd be a Conservative. I'm not sure that's right either, but there was that claim. Most remarkably of all, you had two things really from 2015. Jeremy Corbyn's supporters describing Jeremy Corbyn as, again, the heir to Attlee, saying they used to wear these "What Would Clem Do" T-shirts at a lot of the rallies, although Jeremy Corbyn himself is much more critical. And secondly, you know, Theresa May, in her 2015 conference speech, mentions Attlee as this politician she admires. So I think there's a recognition that the Attlee qualities, silent, steely reserve, tolerance for other people's opinions, a lack of showiness in politics, a career before politics, it's not just pure sort of PR and then becoming an MP, all this sort of sense of a desire for experience and respect, it's there. I just don't think anyone's quite fastened upon it and got it. And my view is whoever produces the most Attleeist program in the next general election is actually the one most likely to win.
The book has certainly given me an insight into a man whose name I've heard an awful lot mentioned but didn't really know very much about. It's a terrific audiobook as well, which is rare for history, which can sometimes come across as a little bit dry on audio. Were you involved in choosing the narrator for the audiobook?
I didn't choose the narrator. Once you write these books, it's very tough to look at them again. And my wife is currently, because we've got a little girl who just shouted downstairs, she's currently actually listening to the audiobook when she takes her for a walk on the pram. And what was very nice is the narrator actually got in contact and offered to do it because he'd really enjoyed the book. So I'm told it's a really good narration. I just can't listen to it because it's like listening to the sound of your own voice. It's too strange for me, but I am told it really works quite well.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself normally? Or
I do listen to some some audiobooks. Yeah, it kind of it helps with the kid or on long journeys when you can't carry too many books with you. Absolutely.
You must be delighted that your book is reaching a wider audience who can't necessarily read it in print.
I'm really happy. And in fact, I've had lots of emails and people writing to me saying, will it be out in an audiobook? I'm very interested in this. In Attlee. I'm a child of the Attlee government. I remember my parents talking about Attlee. So I'm really happy we've been able to make it an audiobook.
And finally, who are you going to turn your attention and scholarship to next?
Biography next. I've done two biographies, so I don't want to be a one-trick pony. So I'm going to write a little bit about the foreign policy of the Attlee era and this building of the post-1945 international order, but take a kind of more panoramic international view of that, the sort of building of this Western world order and what's happened to it since. So kind of a big, broad, kind of a rise and fall type sweeping book. But I'm very much at the start of it right now, just collecting books and materials. And it'll be 3-4 years in the making, I think.
In between changing nappies.
In between changing nappies, exactly.
Well, Professor John Bew, thank you so much for telling us more about the fascinating life of Citizen Clem Attlee.
Thank you, Red. Thank you.
Citizen Clem is out now in print, audio, and ebook format, and it's a fascinating read. Many of the books that influenced Clem Attlee can be found in the RNIB library, including William Morris's News from Nowhere, which is TB 17045, and The Ragged Trousered Philanthropists by Robert Tressel, which is TB 3720. And we'll be hearing more from John Bew at the end of the show.
Eye health tips for winter. Winter is here, and snow can reflect up to 80% of UV rays. The effects of UV light are cumulative and can cause cataracts over a long period of time. If you're going on a family skiing holiday this winter, make sure your children are wearing UV 400 sunglasses. Protective goggles are important when skiing to prevent eye injuries from branches and debris. The holiday period is also tempting for poor diet choices. Try to eat plenty of leafy greens, fruit, and omega-3 fatty acids for better eye health. And don't ignore your eyes this winter.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Still to come on this week's show, Marion Vivers takes us back to the late 18th century to compare the lives of two very different literary women, Jane Austen and Dorothy Wordsworth. But first, like John Bew, Jonathan Dimbleby is a man with a keen interest in modern political history. He told Robert Kirkwood what led him to write about a pivotal World War II tank battle.
Well, I had been interested in a general way for quite a long time. So a long time ago, I wrote a biography of my father. And between 1940 and 1942, as the battle raged to and throw across the desert, he was there as the BBC's first war correspondent in the Middle East, in Egypt and in Libya. And I'd written about his experiences there when I wrote this biography, which was 35 years ago. And then I was approached by publishers, said, would you like to write about it? And I thought, well, would I like to write about it? I'm not sure, because there have been a huge number of books written about the conflict in the desert and its implications and so forth. And then I started to read, and I started looking, and I thought, yeah, I've actually got something to say about it, I think. And essentially, it was to say that this was a pivotal struggle in the Middle East, and then explain why it was, because a lot of people just tell the story of the battle, which is a very dramatic story. And as you indicated, large numbers of casualties, many people killed, many wounded, many incinerated in tanks, losing limbs and losing eyesight.
Now, Churchill said before Alamein, we never had a victory, and after, we never had a defeat. Is that true?
Not quite. There were victories before. There was a victory in 1941 when we reached a very long way, drove Rommel all the way back into Libya and nearly to the capital, reached Benghazi and could have carried on. And there were defeats after in Italy.
Mm.
But he did actually say, it may almost be said. He was very good. People left out those phrases. And he had these famous phrases about the Battle of El Alamein, and he'd said after it was over, on the 10th of November at the Mansion House in London, he said, this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. And it was indeed true, because the Allies went on to fight in North Africa, the Americans alongside the British, defeating the Germans and the Italians there, 250,000 prisoners, then across to Italy and up through Italy, very bitter fighting, far fiercer than had been imagined, while at the same time the huge battles were going on in Russia, with the Russians turning the tide there. So it was a pivotal moment in the war. I don't seek to say that the Battle of El Alamein itself defeated the Germans, but it was at a key point, and it increased dramatically morale in the armed forces, in the British armed forces. It demonstrated to the Americans that the British could win as well as lose battles. And overall, it was a clear sign that the Germans were about to be on the retreat.
Now, my knowledge of this, fortunately or unfortunately, is mainly based on Spike Milligan's war memoirs. What comes from those is that a lot of the soldiers didn't realise why they were there, why they were actually fighting for sand.
As so often, Spike Milligan hit the nail on the head in his unique fashion. A lot of the soldiers did not know why they were there, and a lot of the commanding officers were not very good at telling them. And the reason why they were there was that the British Empire was absolutely crucial to Britain. We depended on the British Empire for men to fight the war, for material, for resources, for supplies, for food. And there was a huge belief in Britain, very few people countering it, that Britain and the British Empire were integral, part of one another, unimaginable that you would sever Britain from the Empire. And in order to maintain the Empire, you had to keep the Middle East, because the Middle East was the carotid artery, the great artery linking Britain to its empire in Africa and in Asia, and linking us to the Commonwealth countries like New Zealand and Australia, who were also fighting in the Middle East, incidentally.
Now, do you think the victory was as important at home as a propaganda exercise?
It was important. I don't think people were dancing in the streets. Churchill ordered the bells of the churches to ring. They had been silent since the beginning of the war and were only to be rung in the event of an invasion across the Channel by the Germans. And he ordered the bells to be rung in celebration and in gratitude to the men who had fought, 200,000 men who had fought at El Alamein, Scots, English, Welsh, Australians, Indians, New Zealanders, South Africans, Free French and more. So it lifted morale. But I think people sitting in their pubs, sitting around the hearth and listening to the news from the Middle East were saying to themselves, not hurrah, it's now all over by the shouting, but phew, we can actually do it. And I think it was that. It was a quiet achievement, not a noisy one.
Now, you mentioned there were many nations, but in the book it seems there were, for some of them, there were gaps in discipline.
Well, the Australians were very independent, and rather to the admiration of the British soldiers, the Australians did not have a huge amount of respect. They were volunteers, did not have a huge amount of respect for their officers. They absolutely fitted, in that sense, the stereotype of Australians who don't off their caps to anyone. And this was very disconcerting for some British officers who were used to yes sir, no sir and salutes. It didn't alter the behaviour of the British soldiers, who continued to behave in the traditional fashion, but I think they rather liked that lack of deference.
Now, this is now a BBC TV documentary. What came first? Was it the book or the documentary?
It's rather important to me in a rather precious way that the book came first. I wrote the book, and then the BBC, after I'd sent them the preface, said, well, this is very interesting. We would like to make a documentary. And I said, well, I think it's 90 minutes or so. And they said, OK. And then I gave to my very good friend who produced it, I gave him the whole book. and said, now we've got a, it's 180,000 words long, quite a big book. We've now got to turn this into a 90-minute film. Can you do it with me? And he's brilliant. And together we managed to turn it into a film which people seem to have rather liked, which is very gratifying. I think it's important to say, too, what I tried to do in the film, as the book has, is to look at the strategic decisions that were made, being made in Italy, in Germany, in America, and, of course, in London, and the tensions there were there, the diaries and the memoirs and the cables illuminate the extraordinary drama that was being played out in all those capitals, and the relationships between and within those capitals were really quite astonishing. It opened my eyes, and so I tried to link what was happening on the battlefield with the first-hand accounts of what it was like to be there to the what it was like to be there also in Whitehall or in the White House.
Yeah, because it's not only for in the sand that's between politicians and generals, diplomats and civil servants. There's a really awkward photo, or when you read the description of it, it's really awkward that Churchill's sitting next to two people, one of whom he's just fired and someone he fired some time before.
Well, he was there, yes, he was there in Cairo, this is, in August. He flew to Cairo on his way for his first meeting with Stalin, which was an uncomfortable encounter in which he told was to tell Stalin that the Second Front in Europe would not take place until the Americans had joined with the British in November to invade North Africa. And he had sacked Wavell. Wavell and he disliked each other. Wavell was the commander-in-chief in the Middle East, responsible for this vast swathe of land and fought well and defensively with limited resources. He was sacked. Auchinleck came in, a great general who didn't win battles fast enough for Churchill's liking, and he was sacked. And by accident, almost, Montgomery came in to replace him. Mm. And so, the accounts given by those who were present suggested it was a very uncomfortable period, not least, although Churchill, I think, didn't give a what you might call a monkey's, but it was uncomfortable for others.
Now, you narrated this book yourself. How did you find that process?
I found it... I was asked if I would like to, and I had actually the last book I wrote I read as well, which was about Russia, and I knew it would be much more tiring than you think it's going to be. I had a limited amount of time in which to do it, so I would go in fact to a studio in Newton Abbot, which is near where I live in Devon, and get there for 10 o'clock, and I would stagger out at 5 o'clock in the evening with the words swimming around my brain and unable to string words together when I got home. It's much more tiring than you think, but I wanted to do it myself because I work as a broadcaster, and I knew what inflections I hoped would work. Mm. And I thought if you have ownership of those words, which I did... I didn't want to surrender that ownership to someone who, in other terms, I'm sure be very much better qualified to read than me.
It's such a nice feeling when you finish the book as well, though.
Oh, it was wonderful. You see, I can't remember the exact... It's about 475 pages. It's a long book, significantly long book. And you start off, and at the end of day one, you're at page 55. And you think to yourself, oh, my goodness, was this a good decision or not? And you have to avoid being grumpy. But I had a very nice producer and a very nice technician who were working with me, and they were very enthusiastic and supportive and kept saying, you're doing amazingly well. Whether they thought that or not in reality, I don't know.
Now, you're in the RNIB Talking Book Studios at the moment. Were you aware that only between 5 and 7% of books will ever be accessible to blind or partially sighted readers?
That's very sad, isn't it? I mean, we live in a world where people with disabilities are supposed to be treated in every way possible as equals. One of those ways, surely, is that those who have difficulty or cannot read... I mean, there are great advances for those who are partially sighted with being able to, on Kindles or in other ways, to blow up the print, and you can have large print books. But there are a great many people for whom that isn't adequate. And it seems to me to be strange. I hadn't, to be honest, I didn't know that figure until you'd just given it to me. But that seems astonishing to me. It ought not to be the case. I mean, you're limiting the horizons of people in a completely arbitrary way, in either for financial or technical reasons. Not good enough. If you write a book, there's no point in writing it for your family, my view. You can talk to your family. It's not a diary. It's a book that you want out there. You want people to read it. I want it to be read as widely and as extensively as possible. Not only, of course, because I earn some money out of it, if the more widely it's read, because more importantly, to be honest, more importantly, because you feel... I mean, it's very odd. I lived inside this period of the war in a way which I'd never imagined beforehand. It was my first history book of you know, totally concentrated history. I read another book in which history comes in. And I've been extremely gratified by what the reviewers have written, what scholars have said about it, and much more importantly, people saying it's a page-turner. Well, if it's a page-turner and a good read and illuminates a very important part of our past, of course I want everyone here in the United Kingdom to read it, but I want others around the world to read it as well.
I've heard that some people, when they're doing a book this intense about history, they tend to sometimes look up from their keyboard and you know, it takes them a second to remember where they are and what year it is.
I had that, absolutely. I was living in that time, and it was more important. You know, I was doing my regular programmes and coming back and doing, as I happen to be going to do this evening, my Any Questions programme on Radio 4, and... All through the period, I had to keep sort of shaking myself and saying, well, actually, whether or not there's a referendum on Europe does matter. What is happening to the unemployment really does matter. And I was thinking all the time, I was living in an extreme environment of the Second World War and filled with the sort of wonder at people's resilience and also at the horror of war. I mean, you're living a horror. There is glory, there is heroism, but overwhelmingly there is horror in war. I actually found myself reading some material and thinking, if I write this or just reproduce it, it's a sort of pornography of violence. And some writing and some books, I think, rather veer towards that. I include some of the most extreme examples, but very, very sprinkled lightly, so that it doesn't just become an account of appalling atrocity. We need to know about atrocity, but we need to put it in the picture, to understand how and why it happened.
In his first speech as Prime Minister on the 13th of May 1940, Winston Churchill told the House of Commons, "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat." As he spoke, the British Expeditionary Force in France was in full retreat towards Dunkirk, its stubborn but forlorn rearguard action powerless to arrest the German advance. Only Hitler's bizarre and unexpected decision to call off the chase allowed the bulk of the BEF and the 1st French Army to reach the beaches at Dunkirk. The Führer's decision infuriated his army commanders, and especially his chief of staff, General Franz Holder, who noted bleakly, "Now we must stand and watch countless thousands of the enemy get away to England right under our noses."
Thanks to Robert and to Jonathan Dimbleby. While Destiny in the Desert has yet to reach the RNIB library shelves, many of his other books are already there, including his biography of the Prince of Wales. You can find a full list by visiting rniblibrary.com or by calling the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and selecting option 5.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, John Bew shares the books of his life. But before that, Marion Vivers is an author and biographer with a special interest in Georgian England. Her new book, Jane and Dorothy, A True Tale of Sense and Sensibility, is a fascinating study of Jane Austen and Dorothy Wordsworth. Both were born in the 1770s, and though they had much in common, they led very different lives. I met Marion at the Wigtown Book Festival and began by asking her, would Jane and Dorothy have liked each other had they ever met?
No, I don't think they would. Almost certainly they would not have liked each other. Jane Austen would have thought Dorothy Wordsworth was over-emotional and a bit silly, and Dorothy Wordsworth would have thought Jane Austen was cold, too reserved, without a reasonable degree of sensibility.
It really does come across as a real-life tale of sense and sensibility. They are rather like the Dashwood sisters.
Yes, I see them as like the Dashwood sisters. I think it's too oversimplistic to say that they are exactly like. And sense and sensibility are qualities which sometimes, I think, people don't always live up to. There are times when Jane can be quite impulsive. There are times when Dorothy Wordsworth can be rather cold and conventional. But overall, I think these are the Jane valued sense and Dorothy valued sensibility. So they were the qualities that they aspired to rather than something that defines them absolutely.
Yes, and they led very different lives as far as their physical circumstances were concerned. Dorothy was off on the fells with William, enjoying nature, whilst Jane was very much at home in Winchester, writing for the majority of her life.
Yes, I think that's very true. Oddly enough, though, as I explore in the book, is Dorothy's apparent freedom, her decision to live with her brother, who was a revolutionary at the time and quite unconventional. Oddly enough, that doesn't seem to have resulted in Dorothy finding a lot of space or opportunity to write herself, whereas Jane, who remained in a conventional home, found the mental space, the imaginative space, to create her own novels.
And do you think there was a sense that Dorothy was very much in the shadow of her successful and rather demanding older brother, William?
Yes, I think she certainly was. William was a very, very strong character. He was always very sure that his opinions were right, and she valued his love. He loved her intensely, but she would not have wanted to do anything of which William would not approve. She always had to live up to William's expectations, I think. And William expected her to be this very free spirit, this slightly unworldly character.
And yet her diaries give a very strong sense of a feeling, thinking, rather emotional woman at times.
Yes, they certainly do. And I think maybe her emotional life became very fraught. She lived in a difficult situation. She loved her brother dearly. He was the emotional centre of her world. But of course he married, and she then had to share him with somebody else. And she does a good job of that.
And do you think she would have made a great novelist had she allowed herself to explore fiction?
My own feeling is yes. I could see Dorothy Wordsworth as a novelist. What most people notice about her journals is her brilliant evocation of place and her descriptions. But actually, the journals are also full of characters, the characters that she saw about her, the characters that she captures, often just in a few lines of what they've said. She actually writes some dialogue in her journal. And that is so evocative that you start to think that maybe she could have created novels, yes.
And you yourself, under a different name, Anna Dee, write the Dido Kent novels, of course.
Yes, that's right. So that's a different, quite light-hearted approach to the... It's the same time. And they're set very much in the world that Jane Austen enjoyed. She describes liking to write about three or four families in a country village. And that's the setting for my Dido Kent novels, essentially. And they're fairly light-hearted, but they allude to Jane Austen's life and work. If you've read Jane Austen's novels and letters, you'll get some extra clues. They're whodunits, but you'll get some extra clues if you know Jane Austen's work.
It was a very difficult time for a woman, the Georgian era. Really, you know, as you said yourself, the only way women could succeed, the only job they were really meant to do was to become wives and mothers. What fascinates you? What makes you feel comfortable as a novelist, a female novelist, writing about that era? Or do you write to expose the male conspiracy that ruled the time?
I don't think it's about a male conspiracy, but it fascinates me because it's a time when women are just beginning to be able to express themselves. And there are opportunities that they wouldn't have had 100 years before. And it's acceptable for them to say things that they wouldn't have been able to do 100 years before. But they are still very, very restricted. And Dido Kent is, she's my attempt to find a woman who's trying to negotiate her way through that and to find meaning for her own life, but without defying the conventions entirely. She's not a rebel. She's much more of a Jane Austen than a Dorothy Wordsworth.
Are the Dido Kent books available as audiobooks?
Yes, they are.
One final question. If you were only allowed to spend a day with either Jane Austen or Dorothy Wordsworth, who would you choose?
Jane Austen, definitely.
Me too. Marion Vivas, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marion Vivas' Jane and Dorothy, A True Tale of Sense and Sensibility, is out now in print and ebook formats. Her Dido Kent mysteries, written under her pen name of Anna Dean, are also available commercially in print and as audiobooks. Do you have a favourite novelist you'd like us to feature on the show? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now it's back to historian John Bew for the books of his life. I started by asking him, was there a book that inspired him when he was a young man to become a writer?
Well, my parents are both historians, so I actually tended to steer clear of history books growing up because it looked like work to me. So I read a lot of novels, and I loved actually the novels of Robert Louis Stevenson in particular. So any collection really is kind of the Treasure Island type of variety. I was to say that's the type of thing that really got me inspired when I was younger and would sort of take me away to a different mental place.
I was now, it seemed, cut off upon both sides. Behind me the murderers, before me this lurking nondescript. And immediately I began to prefer the dangers that I knew to those I knew not. Silver himself appeared less terrible in contrast with this creature of the woods. And I turned on my heel, and looking sharply behind me over my shoulder, began to retrace my steps in the direction of the boats. Instantly the figure reappeared, and making a wide circuit began to head me off. I was tired at any rate, but had I been as fresh as when I rose, I could see that it was in vain for me to contend in speed with such an adversary. From trunk to trunk the creature flitted like a deer, running man-like on two legs, but unlike any man that I'd ever seen, stooping almost double as it ran. Yet a man it was, I could no longer be in doubt about that.
A clip from Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. It's narrated by Gabriel Wolfe and it's TB655. And then, is there a book that on a rainy day with nothing else to do you'd like to curl up on the sofa with and reread?
Really, this is a sense of a rite of passage. I started War and Peace and got quite far on it on honeymoon. It was an absurd thing to take it on honeymoon, but never finished it. And 3-4 years into marriage, it still hasn't been completed yet. So less for relaxation, more because I feel like I should do it. I want to pick up War and Peace again halfway through, although I fear with those long Russian names I may have to go back to the start again.
He had just entered, wearing an embroidered court uniform. knee breeches and shoes, and had stars on his breast and a serene expression on his flat face. He spoke in that refined French in which our grandfathers not only spoke but thought, and with the gentle, patronizing intonation natural to a man of importance, who had grown old in society and at court. He went up to Anna Pavlovna, kissed her hand, presenting to her his bald, scented, and shining head, and complacently seated himself on the sofa. "First of all, dear friend, tell me how you are. Set your friend's mind at rest," said he, without altering his tone, beneath the politeness and affected sympathy of which indifference and even irony could be discerned.
A clip from War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy, which is TB1374. And at nearly 79 hours, it must be one of the longest books in the RNIB library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the audience?
I read a lot of Americana, actually. I'm really interested in the sort of state of American politics and history. So my book of the year last year, writing for the New Statesman, was J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, which is a kind of a state of America, and he talks about, he's a kind of a American from a redneck, blue-collar, white working-class background, part in the Appalachians, part in the Midwest in America. He talks about the sort of the declining state of that place and his own sort of breakaway from it. And actually, when Donald Trump was elected president, the book, J.D. Vance's book, surged the bestseller list, New York Times bestseller list in January, straight after the inauguration, as a kind of an attempt, written before Trump, but it's an attempt to make sense of the kind of forces that fed into Trumpism. So I'd really recommend that. I think it's absolutely superb, short, and it's snappy and very compelling.
I want people to know what it feels like to nearly give up on yourself and why you might do it. I want people to understand what happens in the lives of the poor and the psychological impact that spiritual and material poverty has on their children. I want people to understand the American dream as my family and I encountered it. I want people to understand how upward mobility really feels. And I want people to understand something I learned only recently, that for those of us lucky enough to live the American dream, the demons of the life we left behind continue to chase us.
J.D. Vance reading his book, Hillbilly Elegy, which is TB700541. Professor John Bew, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On Air listeners.
Thank you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch about your book groups, the titles you're reading, and suggestions for books that might broaden my horizons. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You can find a link at our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or just search for RNIB Radio. So, farewell until next week, and remember to read on.